Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands.
This year, however, Palestinians say they were left alone struggling the Israeli occupation and its non-stop attempts to annex more lands, mainly after some Arab states have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv. These ties, Palestinians say, simply undermine efforts for Palestinian state. Palestinian officials stress that what they see as a symbolic international solidarity has failed to give the Palestinian people their rights, while Israel continues to occupy most of the land of historical Palestine.
Israel will not be deterred by statements of condemnation. Israel can be stopped only by popular nonviolent Palestinian struggle and boycott, divestment, sanctions against its system of apartheid. That's what we want to see. BDS, not normalization with occupation.
The UN, meanwhile, has renewed commitment to the Palestinian people. However, its Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has cautioned that the prospects for a viable two-state solution are becoming more distant, mainly with Israel's expansion of illegal settlements, a significant spike in the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, violence, and continued militant activity. After more than 40 years since the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the UN, Palestinian rights remain usurped and the dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. Ona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Venezuela's judiciary has convicted a group of former oil executives who plotted with the U.S. government against the interests of the South American country Citgo Petroleum Corporation, which is based in the United States. The judicial ruling comes at a time when Caracas is fighting to regain control of Citgo, as the company was illegally confiscated by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. Citgo's former executives were found guilty of passing secret information to American authorities in order to inflict damage on Venezuela's oil industry, a misconduct that is regarded as a major crime in Venezuela. In this scenario, officials support the judicial verdict.
The judge's decision is aimed at protecting our country's oil industry from U.S.-funded spies like ex-Citgo executives.
On the flip side, the opposition criticizes this legal case.
There is not enough evidence of conspiracy between the former executives and the U.S., so this court ruling is politically motivated.
Nonetheless, experts say the country's judiciary issued the right verdict.
The former executives are the Venezuelans who hold U.S. citizenship. That's a felony itself, in case you are the manager of a Venezuelan company.
Venezuela's judiciary has punished the former oil executives for their complicity with the U.S. Analysts say this is part of Caracas's legal actions to get back Citgo, the oil company that was illegally confiscated by Washington. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
A human tide, rarely seen, flooded in the streets of Paris and all over France in a freedom march against a new security law. The massive protest is held against President Macron's government that is pushing a new bill that restricts the ability to film police. Human rights associations and media are unanimous. This law would allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished.
There's a huge popular opposition against this law. Even the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations and other international bodies criticize it. A social majority in this country refuses the implementation of this law. Since a long time, they alert the government on police brutality and violence against women. Violence against women during the lockdown is exploding, and the government remains inactive and guilty.
Two major events this week plead in favor of the protesters and of the importance of video footage to denounce police violence. First, French police dismantled a migrant camp in central Paris. The French government ordered an internal police investigation after police officers were filmed tossing migrants out of tents and intentionally tripping one while evacuating a protest camp.
It is important to film this kind of situations because it's part of freedom of expression. Filming with our phones is almost the only way of publishing this kind of violence against migrants, people from the suburb, against everybody.
And then a second video showed the violent arrest of a black music producer in Paris. Three police officers repeatedly punched and hit him during 20 minutes. The man told that the officers made racist insults.
Thanks to the images showing the beating by a kind of private militia attacking a music producer, the truth has come out. Without this video footage from a surveillance camera, the man would be in prison accused for using violence against the police. That shows the importance of having a counterpower in this country.
Under a huge pressure, Interior Minister Darmanin announced disciplinary proceedings as soon as possible, but that might be too little, too late. In the meantime, the protest is going on.
A large majority in the French parliament voted in favor of the security law, but the Senate still has to approve it. Right-wing senators, a majority in the Senate, declared they will rewrite the law because it is unconstitutional. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese have bid farewell to their last democratically elected prime minister, who died of COVID-19-related complications at 84. According to the National Umma Party, which he led until his death, Sadiq al-Mahdi died in hospital in the United Arab Emirates, where he was receiving treatment after becoming infected with the novel coronavirus in October.
I think the loss of the Sadiq al-Mahdi, the Umma Party leader, and the Sudanese, the most intellectual person in the Sudanese political process, is so great loss. This is it will be reflecting on all and whole the political process.
Imam Sadiq is the greatest one in the Sudan, and this era need him. Why? Because according to the government,
Al-Mahdi served as the prime minister in the mid-60s and again in the mid-80s before he was overthrown in a coup of 1989, which led to rise power of President Omar al-Bashir. After being forced out of office, Al-Mahdi remained a leading politician in Sudan. In a statement, Sudan Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok described him as one of the most important figures of thought, politics, literature and wisdom in the country. Meanwhile, senior National Umma Party said that the party will continue to follow the anti-Israel policies taken by the late Sadiq al-Mahdi.
We have our own doctrine based on the Islamic ethics. We are against the normalization. If the needs arise, not al-Burhan, neither Hamdok will decide on behalf of the Sudanese people. The elected, the coming elected parliament will decide on the behalf of the Sudanese nation.
I think this constitution will go in the same road of the leader Sadiq al-Mahdi in the normalization, against the normalization or any establishment of the relationship between the Sudan and Israel.
Al-Mahdi was a well-known Sudanese political figure who played an important role in public affairs and wrote several books addressing the situation in Sudan.
For more than 60 decades, Sadiq al-Mahdi was icon of democracy, Islamic thought, and a strong opponent of imperialism in Sudan and abroad. Mohamed Fazari from Khartoum, Sudan, city of Omdurman.
2:30 p.m. local time on Friday in a countryside area east of Tehran. A truck loaded with explosives blew up to intercept the car carrying top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Eyewitnesses say five or six gunmen then rushed from a nearby vehicle and opened fire on his car. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but medics were unable to save his life. The incident immediately sent its shockwaves across Iran and beyond, with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calling the attack an act of terror and linking it to Israel. Inside Iran, the assassination comes as a shock. Less than 24 hours after the incident, people from all walks of life gathered outside the Iranian parliament to condemn the assassination, which they view as grave as the U.S.'s assassination of top IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani in January.
What happened to our nuclear scientist was carried out by the same terrorists who killed Qasem Soleimani. Like Mr. Soleimani, Fakhrizadeh offered many services to our nation.
If we back down on this terrorist act, the U.S. and Israel will become more insolent towards us. We have gathered here to urge the government and lawmakers to take a tough stance towards the perpetrators to avoid further such incidents.
Fakhrizadeh served as the head of the Research and Innovation Organization of the Defense Ministry. Iranian officials say he had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's nuclear energy program.
Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
This had made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
Israel is not willing to see Iran's advancement in science and technology. It killed four other Iranian nuclear scientists, and now it assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. But Israel should know that it cannot stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, because those martyrs have trained numerous young scientists who will take the lead in this field.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Fakhrizadeh now becomes the fifth Iranian nuclear scientist who was eliminated in a terror attack. While all indications attest to an Israeli involvement, Iranians here demand that the government take a harsh revenge. This, they say, would reduce the chances of more Iranian scientists becoming an easy target for terrorists. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, all electoral processes in the region were suspended and Kashmir came under the direct control of New Delhi. Also, the role of major pro-India political parties in Kashmir was belittled after New Delhi detained all pro-India politicians. The absence of people's political participation created a void in Kashmir's political sphere and raised many questions on New Delhi's claims of normalcy in the region. And to break the ice, amid tough security measures, New Delhi is holding local elections in 8 phases, ending on December 19th. A large number of voters has braved cold weather to vote, and each of them has their own reasons.
Our educated youth are doing menial jobs. We have problems like improper roads and lack of electricity. Who will take up our issues to higher-ups? That's why we voted for our trusted candidate.
Election boycott calls enforced by the pro-independence camp of Kashmir were highly supported by the people of Kashmir. But this time they say they want to fight for equality and justice via elections.
We are seeking respect since we are treated as second-class citizens. The country's progress hardly reaches us. By casting our vote, we tell the champions of democracy to do justice. Earlier, our election boycott was an excuse for them. Now we will give them no excuse. We want equal rights and treatment.
While voters have their own reasons to cast ballots, candidates have their aims too.
I can't promise my people jobs and land rights because with Article 370 everything is gone. My goal is to safeguard my people against the plots of people with anti-Muslim agendas. I believe in peace and tranquility and I want to work for secularism in my bloc.
The main contesting parties in this local election are Bharatiya Janata Party, Indian National Congress and Alliance of Local Political Parties.
Amid heightened security, the elections in Indian-administered Kashmir are being portrayed by many as a step towards normalcy and peace in the region. However, experts say such electoral processes have hardly helped Kashmir in the past, adding long-lasting peace is only possible when the issue gets permanently resolved between India and Pakistan. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Despite the apparent demise of the Trump era, it is clear that the far-right movement in the West is still alive and well. White supremacy, racism and xenophobia are problems in every EU country.
But this is the end! It's the end! Enough's enough!
Coordinated by the European Commission Brussels, religious leaders from all of the main faiths have just taken part in a video conference.
Reports of anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim attacks are now almost part of everyday life in our beloved Europe.
The leaders say the answer is to show more unity and greater mutual respect.
I want to say that if somebody hurts a Muslim sister, a Jewish brother, they are hurting me.
The European Union's much-criticized asylum policy also came under the spotlight during the event.
Europe loses its soul if we continue to watch people drowning in the Mediterranean. That is why we support civil rescue missions.
Religious leaders insist the European Union must do more to ensure refugees play a positive and productive role in society. Experts agree.
There were mistakes in integration of the migrants, and there were mistakes in education, or lack of education, or lack of access to the educational system.
In the past, Saudi Arabia has been criticized for sponsoring terrorism in the EU. The European Commission says it is easier to brainwash vulnerable young men when they do not feel part of a community.
This sense of belonging would be the best shield against radicalization, terrorism, and hatred.
Work is continuing to try and curtail terrorist recruitment online in the EU. However, sociologists believe that is not the root cause of the security issue.
They say the source of the problem is not the internet, but the current climate within society. The focus should be on changing that, they argue. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After a long hunger strike going beyond 100 days to protest against his detention without charge or trial, Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras has been finally freed. The Israeli authorities released al-Akhras from the Israeli hospital of Qablan, where he was held for subsequent worsening of his health condition. He arrived at Al-Najah hospital in the West Bank city of Nablus following his release by Israeli authorities. After final medical examinations, he was moved to his hometown, Silat al-Dahr, north of the occupied West Bank. In a press statement, al-Akhras thanked the Palestinian people for the solidarity actions and insisted that gaining rights and liberty are only achieved through fighting.
Praise be to God that I am now among my family and my people in Nablus, and that God willing, we will get rid of the occupation with the mighty wills of our people and live from victory to victory until we reach a greater victory and liberate Palestine.
Israel arrested al-Akhras in July over accusations of being a prominent member of the Jihad resistance group, which he denied. He immediately started his hunger strike, demanding that he should either be prosecuted for clear charges or be released. Israel at first refused to deal with his demands, but when he was at the verge of death, the Israeli High Court ruled that if al-Akhras ended his hunger strike, his administrative detention would not be renewed upon its expiration on 6th of November. Prominent figures who rushed to welcome al-Akhras praised his encouragement in what they described as defeating the occupation's authorities. Administrative detention involves no indictment, no revelation of confidential evidence, and no trial or judgment of the accusations against the prisoner. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are languishing in Israel's jails without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. The inmates say their hunger strike is a bet to have their voice heard and to force the Israeli regime to end this illegal policy. Reports say more than 7,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Maher al-Akhras has achieved victory through his hunger strike, and he's free today. Experts say his battle definitely gives other Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention a glimmer of hope, enabling them to go on with their actions and their fight for justice that aim to get back their rights in Israeli jails. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, said in a report that Israel's prolonged blockade of the Gaza Strip and the regime's military operations against the Palestinian enclave had inflicted some $17 billion U.S. dollars in losses between 2007 and 2018. Richard Guzel-Wright, the director of UNCTAD's Globalization and Development Strategies, said that it was extremely difficult to see anything but de-development being the fate of Gaza society. The Israeli regime has placed the Gaza Strip under a tight blockade since 2007 and waged three wars on it since 2008. The blockade and military operations had driven the poverty rate in Gaza to increase almost fourfold compared with normal conditions.
The losses that were highlighted in the UNCTAD report show the extent of damage caused by the Israeli blockade and wars against the Gaza Strip, especially the three major wars since 2008. Israel has systematically destroyed civilian infrastructure and economic sectors, in addition to the loss of innocent lives.
According to the UNCTAD report, Gaza has witnessed one of the worst economic performances globally. In addition to killing and maiming thousands of Gazans during the wars, Israeli forces also bombed civilian infrastructure, as well as thousands of factories and businesses.
The Palestinian economy in Gaza is collapsing because of the Israeli wars and blockade. Israel waged three major wars in less than 10 years and destroyed all aspects of our economy in Gaza.
As day laborers, we sustained heavy losses because of the wars. Factories were destroyed during the wars, and thousands of people lost their sources of income.
UNCTAD says its estimates are partial because they cover only the economic cost of the Israeli occupation from the prolonged closure and recurrent military operations in Gaza from 2007 to 2018. Experts say the Israeli regime must be held accountable for its illegal policies against the Palestinian people.
Israeli military aggressions and the blockade amount to war crimes, and the international community must bring an end to Israel's impunity. The Palestinian Authority and human rights organizations must also include the economic file in their complaints at the International Criminal Court because Israel perpetrated war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Observers say that for Gaza's economy to slightly recover, the blockade must be fully lifted. According to UN figures, the Israeli regime is responsible for the near collapse of Gaza's regional economy and its isolation from the Palestinian economy and the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio.
programs to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إن هذه القلوب تمل كما تمل الأبدان فابتغوا لها طرائف الحكمة.
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, "The hearts become tired as the bodies become tired. You should therefore search for beautiful sayings for them to enjoy by way of refreshment."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the great and profound lessons which we learn from Imam Ali's universal persona and his life in general is this concept about sacrifice on the path of Allah and steadfastness on the path of God. We find that throughout his life, Imam Ali alayhi salam sacrificed himself, his life, his wealth, his everything for the sake of Allah, and that he always remained steadfast despite the most difficult of situations. He remained steadfast upon the path of Allah. In one of these stories, we find that Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, sacrificed his life for the Messenger of Allah by putting on his clothes and lying in his bed on a specific night, which is called Laylat al-Mabit. Now, this Laylat al-Mabit, the night of Mabit, is the night when the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, left Mecca for Medina in the middle of the night, secretly away from the eyes, concealed from the eyes of the people of Quraysh. Now these polytheists, these people who were ascribing partners to Allah, they came in to the Holy Prophet's house and they started to throw stones at Imam Ali's body, thinking that it was the Holy Prophet. These people of Quraysh, on the night of Laylat al-Mabit, about 40 men had gathered together with spears and, according to this narration, with stones, trying to kill the Holy Prophet. And so first, it seems that they threw stones at him. The polytheists kept on throwing stones at Imam Ali. But Imam Ali, he wrapped himself in this garment, in this cloak, over his head until the morning, meaning he never stuck his head out or he didn't say anything to make the polytheists or the assassins believe that it wasn't the Holy Prophet. All the way until the morning, when the polytheists found out that they were throwing stones at the wrong person, they cursed at Imam Ali, saying, "Whatever stones we threw at him," he didn't even say a word other than raising his voice when he was in pain. Hence, it was strange for us, and we did not realize whether it was Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him, or someone else who was lying in his bed. How beautifully Imam Ali alayhi salam sacrificed his life, put his life on the line in order to protect the Holy Messenger, in order to protect Islam, in order to protect the sanctities of Islam. A very, very profound and deep lesson for all of us to think over, sacrificing on the path of Allah and steadfastness on the path of God, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
And this last will of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Sayyid Razi has included this in the section of Nahl Balagha dealing with the letters of Ali, because this was a written document. And this is letter number 47 of Nahl Balagha. And so this is Mustanat, as we call it. Authentic last will of Amir al-Mu'mineen, which he wanted it to be not only for his family, but for the entire Shia community, even for those who will come in the future. Now he is addressing everyone. Usikuma. Again, singling out his two sons. I advise both of you, wa jamia waladi wa ahli, and all my children and my family. Wa man balaghahu kitabi, and whoever to whom my writing reaches. So this was a written, you know, wasiyat of Ali. So it is, Ali is actually talking to each one of us. Don't look at this as history. This is Ali talking to us even after 14 centuries. What is the first thing he says? Usikum bi taqwa Allah. Again, emphasizing the issue of taqwa of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And what is after taqwa? Wa nazm amrikum. It's amazing the way Ali talks about it. He says, after the taqwa and consciousness of Allah, Ali says, I would like to see organization and system in your personal and communal life. Don't be disorganized. Be munazzam. Be organized. And when we want to see organization, where do we see? In the east or in west? And this is where we have to realize Ali is talking about issues which are not only for 1400 years ago, even relevant to our own time. وصلاح الزات بينكم, and always try to make peace among people of your own in the community. Whenever there is dispute, you should move forward in order to create peace. Why? فإني سمعت جدكما, because I have heard your grandfather addressing Hassan and Hussein here, although the wasiyat is for everyone there, that I have heard your grandfather saying, صلاح ذات البين أفضل من عامة الصلاة والصيام. Making peace between two individuals in the eyes of Allah has more merit and reward than praying for whole year and fasting for whole year. Look at that. One side, the issue of, you know, social harmony. So social and communal organization and harmony and peace in the community.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Of Saud. In the early 20th century, they expanded their kingdom in Saudi Arabia, relying on Wahhabi and Bedouin people called the Muslim Brotherhood. Even hundreds of years later, the sword is still prominent in Saudi royal families' glorious festivals with leaders of great nations of the world. But now, the Saudi royal family spending petrodollars to buy modern arms, and the sword, that is a relic of the past, is the only ornament of the events. But all these arms purchases have not been able to help maintain the glory of this family in critical moments, as it did 100 years ago. Today, the Saudi royal family needs the sword even more than when they took power in the Arabian Peninsula with the Muslim Brotherhood swords.
Look at the whole country, where it was, where it is now. Now, if you tell me that building this whole country and spending 350 billion out of 400 billion, that we had a misused or get corrupted with 50 billion, I'll tell you yes, but I'll take that any time. We did not invent corruption. This happened since Adam and Eve. I mean, Adam and Eve were in heaven, and they had hanky-panky, and they had to go down to earth. So, I mean, this is human nature. But we are not as bad as you think.
Bandar bin Sultan received an Airbus A340 just as one of his birthday gifts, one that was worth $75 million. This gift is decorated with the color of his favorite football team, Dallas Cowboys. Bandar bin Sultan is the son of one of the 14 wives of Sultan bin Abdulaziz. He received pilot training in Cranwell, England, and then joined Royal Saudi Air Forces in 1969 as a second lieutenant. He was knowledgeable in this field.
His Royal Highness Prince Bandar has been at the heart of many of the great world events of the past 30 years. I was always pleased to see him when I was Prime Minister, because he brought me extraordinary insights and bold proposals. I know how much he has contributed to Saudi Arabia's friendship with the United States. We in Britain also have a special affection for him because of his early training at Royal Air Force Cranwell and his generous support for good causes here. It's wonderful to see his contribution to world affairs properly recognized in this excellent book by William Simpson. I salute a prince, a statesman, and a friend.
In 2006, Margaret Thatcher talked about the biography of Bandar bin Sultan that was written by his close friend, William Simpson. She did it because of Bandar bin Sultan's high-level position. This message indicates complex and yet deep Saudi-UK relations.
I'm delighted to send you this message to mark the publication of The Prince. The book tells the story of a truly remarkable man, fighter pilot, ambassador, indefatigable traveler, a man of action.
The story of Bandar bin Sultan's political life is a special example of the power structure in the House of Saud and what goes on between Saudi Arabia and other countries. Bandar started his journey flying his birthday gift, a story that is always linked to oil and arms in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia began arms purchase in the 1960s, a time when Saudi oil revenues were rising and growing every day. Jeffrey Edwards, a businessman from Yorkshire, traveled to Saudi Arabia to sign civil contracts in 1962. Later, he realized that there was a profitable market for arms sales. He went to Jeddah and began to establish close ties with one of the key members of the royal family, Sultan bin Abdulaziz, Minister of Defense and Aviation. Of course, at this time, the United States was one of Britain's serious rivals in this trade, which was trying to sign contracts to deliver arms to Saudi Arabia. However, the U.S. refused to provide advanced fighters such as Starfighter, made by Lockheed Martin, due to concerns about the Saudi military's superiority in the region and destabilization of the security, especially in relation to Israel. The King of Saudi Arabia was disappointed with the U.S. arms deal, and this disappointment created a golden opportunity for Britain.
Foreign buyers representing airlines, air forces, and industry came, saw, and were conquered. Within hours of the show opening, salesmen had taken orders worth millions and had the promise of more contracts to follow.
After several years of Jeffrey Edwards' efforts, Britain became able to sell a significant amount of modern military weapons to Saudi Arabia. It was coincided with the formation of government by the British Labour Party in 1964, a time when the country was facing a severe financial crisis. It was the greatest contract up to that date.
His Majesty King Faisal had flown to London Airport. He now arrived by car at the Tate Gallery, where he was welcomed by the Queen and Duke.
When Faisal bin Abdulaziz Al Saud came to power in Saudi Arabia, West Asia was at the height of the Arab Cold War. Saudi royal family sought to protect Saudi Arabia from the region's growing dangers by purchasing modern Western arms. This contract was signed officially in December 1965. It included 42 BAC Lightning aircraft and a number of aerial surveillance systems. Faisal was assassinated in a terrorist act by a member of the royal family in 1975, but the arms deals remained intact. The next arms deal was reached in 1976, a year after King Faisal's death, as Sultan bin Abdul Aziz was still Saudi defense minister. Britain was trying to make the Royal Saudi Air Force completely dependent on itself by selling such amounts of weapons. During these years, numerous contracts were signed for the supply of Saudi weapons. British companies paid a large sum of money as bribes to princes, especially the Saudi Minister of Defense. For instance, in the 1977 contract, which was worth £500 million, they paid £60 million to princes who played key roles, and the UK government was aware of it. In fact, the money was paid to the princes out of Saudi citizens' pocket. William Morris wrote in a note that the Saudi royal family had turned Saudi Arabia into a private, exclusive, and family-owned company. But Al Yamama was an unbelievable deal which came up later. In the early 80s, Britain was trying to sign new foreign contracts as the country was facing a severe financial crisis.
We're in the Ministry of Defense in Whitehall. Behind these doors, there's a room which few people, apart from Arab sheikhs and other potential foreign customers, have ever set eyes on before. This is it, the Permanent Defense Equipment Exhibition, the supermarket of the sales organization, which this year will sell nearly £600 million worth of British military hardware to foreign governments. Week in, week out, overseas service chiefs come here discreetly to shop for anything from guided missile destroyers and aircraft to a pair of army boots.
Saudi Arabia and Britain entered into tough and breathtaking negotiations to sign a historic arms deal called Yamama. The deal could save Britain's bankrupt economy led by Margaret Thatcher. The key figure in this lucrative trade was none other than the son of the then Minister of Defense, Bandar bin Sultan. He was the grandson of Abdul Aziz, the founder of Saudi Arabia, who was the country's powerful ambassador to Washington since 1985. The deal was concluded on September 26, 1985, and was worth £43 billion. It was the largest trade deal in British exports history to date and seriously affected the political ties between Britain and Saudi Arabia for the next 30 years.
The extraordinary arms deal, which has impressed military experts throughout the world, it emerged today that Britain and Saudi Arabia have signed what's thought to be one of the world's biggest arms agreements. The deal will mean Saudi Arabia will get many more combat planes, training aircraft, new mine hunters, two new air bases, and much training and support. It means Britain is pulling level with, if not overtaking, the United States as the biggest military supplier to the Saudis.
BAE was the most important company in this deal because the largest volumes of these orders were Tornadoes, Hawk jets training aircraft, and missiles for these fighters. In return, Saudi Arabia paid 600,000 barrels of oil a day to Britain for this military equipment. The deal created thousands of direct jobs in Britain as well as in Saudi Arabia. Margaret Thatcher's son in Britain and Bandar bin Sultan in Saudi Arabia, who signed these deals at the highest levels, benefited the most. Newly and erroneously released British government secret documents state that each Tornado was worth £16 million. Bandar bin Sultan's father paid £21 million for each, so he paid £600 million in total. BAE, the British Defense, Security and Aerospace Company, was the contracting party in Yamama deal. BAE is the second largest defense industry company in the world after Lockheed Martin. Not every term of the deal was disclosed, but the ones that were revealed the purchase of more than 96 Tornado fighter jets, 24 Tornado air defense fighter jets, 50 Hawks, and 50 Pilatus PC-9 training aircraft as its main part. Many missiles and ammunition were also purchased for these aircraft. A significant amount of money was spent on training, repairing, and the maintenance of these arms. Of course, this was only the first phase of the deal, and the second phase was signed on July 3, 1988. In the remote island of Bermuda, where the defense ministers of both countries were present. Now we may easily understand which deals prompted a $75 million birthday present for Bandar bin Sultan. BAE gave him this gift for his efforts to sign Ayyamama deal so that he could comfortably have his business and leisure trips around the world. It took a year to make his favorite interior design so he could go on his long journeys seeking his strange plans. He celebrated his meetings and birthday parties with his friends on this plane. He made a great profit in this historic deal, and it made him one of the key players in Saudi royal family. In the following years, he reached an important position in the country's foreign relations, which was specially related to Washington and London. His role was changing at the time. He was changing from a pacifist diplomat to a sponsor of the CIA's secret operations around the world in the 1980s, and most importantly, an arms dealer.
You have no problems working with the CIA.
We have no problem working with the United States government. And unless the CIA does not work for the United States government, then I think we have a bigger problem.
There have been occasions when some Americans have questioned that, as you know.
Well, thank heavens those occasions was not in connection with Saudi Arabia.
He was in charge of one of the most important UK-Saudi activities, and that was funding secret CIA's projects around the world. One of the most important cases was funding the Contras to fight against the revolutionary government in Nicaragua. The Reagan administration, with the guidance of national security advisors, gave the Contras large sums of money to continue their activities, and Saudi Arabia was one of the main sources.
The joint hearings of the House Select Committee to Investigate Covert Arms Transaction will come to order.
Assistance we could provide, some cases arms sales, and he intended to provide a contribution of $1 million per month to the Contras through the end of the year.
Since the middle of 1984, the United States provided $1 million a month for the Contras, and that amount was doubled since early 1985. The Contras received a total of $32 million. The Contra rebels, whom Reagan called freedom fighters, did not refrain from committing any crime against Nicaraguan people in the 1980s. Another generous Saudi contribution to CIA projects was the $50 million donation to UNITA rebel group in Angola to overthrow the MPLA communist government through Morocco. They financially supported Afghan Mujahideen fighters during the years of Soviet occupation of Afghanistan as well. Saudi Arabia sponsored a significant part of the financial support to the Afghan Mujahideen fighters, as well as to those who came from all over the world to fight against the Soviet occupiers. The youth became known as Arab Afghans and years later founded Al-Qaeda, under the leadership of Osama bin Laden.
American Saudi Arabia put $1 billion each to give them arms, training, equipment. We are the ones who cleared all those people to go. We and you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.